We had our school play here last night. Many of you were there. If you look up, you see a bank of theater lights, which we don't usually have, which we're now trying to find the right colors for us. We joke, we were playing in here the other evening when it was all dark with the red lights, which we had on at the beginning here, you might have noticed. I had said that if you illuminated me with red lights in the dark, I might have inspirations I didn't usually have. For a while there, we were shining the red lights, and I thought we might have a very unusual sermon. We were about to see what would happen. Now we have this nice gold, so maybe that will work. This word intuition, which is the foundation of our reading for today, is really one of the most fundamental words in the spiritual path. Swamiji, it's, of course, it's just a word, but the meaning that Swami gives to it in simplest form, people often ask, what is intuition? Swamiji says, intuition is the soul's power of knowing. It's a very interesting statement, the soul's power of knowing. And the life that we live in human bodies is the soul identified, falsely identified, but temporarily identified with the human body. That's the definition of ego. We have an ego because the soul, which is infinite in nature, has become convinced, has defined itself by that which comes and goes, which is the physical body comes and goes, but the consciousness that is our true nature is like the depth of the ocean, and all the bodies that we have are like the waves that rise and fall. It's not that they are unreal, because when the wave is rising, it is really there. When the wave falls, it's falling, it comes and goes. But it's made of the substance of the ocean, and the ocean itself is not fundamentally affected or changed by all the rising and falling of the waves on the surface. And of course, if you're on the surface, you have to relate to the waves. As Master put it, even a dream is real on the level of a dream. It's a subtle understanding that we can't just dismiss easily. But the soul's power of knowing is intuition, and that's how the ego self, the jiva is the actual word for it, which is the individualized sense of self, a little bit separate from the infinite. The jiva's capacity to really know the lasting truth is through the soul's power to know, which is intuition as distinct from the way we reason things out. In this beautiful story about Peter and Christ, and he's asking them a question. When the masters live on the level of a human body, when they've incarnated in human form as we have and communicated with us in human ways, they have to put their thoughts into words, but words are merely the doorway through which those who are listening or reading the scripture can access the soul's power of knowing. It's not the fight over the words that matter. That's why all of this sort of struggle to pin down exactly what this means and that means and which words exactly did Jesus say and so on. It's far less important than using those words as they were intended, which is a portal for something deeper. And this is exactly what Christ was doing. He was testing his disciples to ask them not how great is your reasoning and how astute are your senses, but how clear is your intuition? How clear is your soul's power of knowing? Because nowadays, of course, we have the Bible and everyone to tell us who Jesus was. We have thousands of years of tradition. But at the time, he was a young, radical rabbi who was fighting against the establishment. All of the power and all of the conviction and all of the security was in the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all the priests who ran the temple. And here's this young man who presumably, as we understand now, was part of the Essene community, which was a sort of semi-secret, somewhat mystical remnant of a higher age of Judaism, which was off by itself and somewhat suspect, so they had to keep a little bit secret what they were doing. And so out of that comes this radical man who disappears from the age of 13 to 30, and according now to what people understand to be true and what Master asserts to be true for sure, is he went to India. He studies in India. This is a very orthodox tradition that he's part of. The priesthood, which it doesn't matter what denomination you call it, the established priesthood that has power and wealth from its so-called spiritual position is the same all across the board. It doesn't make any difference what century it is, what denomination, what set of beliefs, it's always the same. It's then the ego becomes defined by that power and position, and it uses whatever dogmas it has primarily to protect itself. It's not fundamentally interested in the truth of things if that truth is going to disrupt the power and the position that it has. So here's this radical rabbi who was very precocious even as a child. At the age of 12, he goes with his family to the temple in Jerusalem, and then the whole caravan goes back to where he lives, and everybody thinks that the boy Jesus is with somebody else, until his mother finally discovers that he's not anywhere and he's lost, and she goes rushing back to the temple, and she finds him sitting in the tradition that they had there in the place where rabbis could come and hold forth, and he's holding forth, he's teaching, he's 12 years old. He's been separated from his parents. He's far from his own home. Now, any child would be at least a little grateful to see its mother. Swamiji describes, in telling this story himself, just being on an ocean liner with his parents when he was a young boy and getting separated from his mother. And he was a little younger than Jesus, but not much. And just how he wept with relief when he finally saw his mother again. Jesus says to his parents, "Why were you looking for me? Don't you know I have to be about my Father's business?" I mean, that was his whole response. What is this human thought that I am really your child? I'm here to serve the world. And so I was starting my mission. And much later, and they say to Jesus, your mother is outside of the room. Your mother and your brother are outside of the room. Now, Mary, of course, was a devoted disciple of his. But he says to his disciples in the room, "Who is my mother? Who is my brother? Except he who loves and serves God." Which is to say, he was the ocean. He was not identified with the waves on the surface. All of these relationships that we cling to so tenaciously that we call family are just relationships of the body or of circumstance. They come and they go, as Master puts it, who was not very romantic, what's the word, sentimental about these sorts of things. He said a woman has a child and the child dies and she weeps with grief and she's so stricken because her child is gone. He said the same soul is born next door and she doesn't even recognize him. I mean, it's not that maybe she would feel an affinity for the child, maybe not. But the thought, this one was mine and all those are others. But this is all the mind's power of knowing, not the soul's power of knowing. And this is where reality mostly is. So here is this rabbi who's gone to India and he's come back with the teachings of Sanatan Dharma that he learned at the feet of the masters of Babaji and Sri Yukteswar. Master said, as most of you have heard here, that when Jesus was the babe in the manger and the three wise men came from the east, that it was the same line of gurus. This is why Jesus is on the altar with these masters, that it's one group of great avatars, one line of gurus working again and again in different forms to uplift this world. And so those who understood who Jesus was didn't understand that because it was the convenient thing to do or because everyone was doing it. It was because when he appeared on the scene, something in their inner soul that transcended, even contradicted the reason of their mind, just responded and went to it. You have those extraordinary stories of Jesus gathering his disciples. Of course, it's all truncated in the Bible, but the kernel of it must be true because it is the way it happens. There are these fishermen, as they describe themselves, just on the beach working, and Jesus walks past them. And all of a sudden, they just know that this is no ordinary man, and everything in them that longs to be free of all the limitations that human life imposes on us, that longs for a happiness that doesn't just rise and fall like the waves on the ocean, just goes toward him. And he turns to him and he says, "Follow me." He doesn't explain what will come from that. He doesn't weigh for them all the alternatives. What will become of this? Who will take care of my fishing boat? You know, what about my mother? And what about my position in society? He just says, "Follow me." And the disciples drop everything. Those who are true, they drop everything and they go with him. I mean, what kind of nutsiness would that be if you were just laying out, you know, right, making a list of this and making a list of that? When I met Swami Kriyananda, by the grace of God, I wasn't able to drop my fishing net and walk after him. But the recognition that I had on a soul level of who this man was in his own consciousness and what that meant to me, as I've written in the book we just published, it was instantaneous. It happened in the space of 5 seconds. From the moment I saw him to the moment I knew that my life would be defined by this man was virtually no time passed. Of course, if you believe in reincarnation, it's not anything. It's just, oh, there you are again. You know, if I meet you all tomorrow when we're both shopping in Whole Foods, we don't have to start over. We just glance and we say, oh, yes, there you are. I mean, I've run into various people in places out of this setting when I'm dressed in my civilian clothes. And those of you who don't live in the community and we don't meet as often, I'll watch that. People will sort of look at me and there'll just be this moment of doubt. And then, oh, of course, I know who you are. But the setting is very different. It's not really dissimilar in a very real sense to just meeting in the next incarnation. There's just this moment of, who are you? Excuse me, I keep fiddling with this. What's wrong? Tell me. Somebody help me. It's supposed to be like unobtrusive and all I do is keep dragging at it. Okay? Has that done it? Keeps whacking at my cheek. Okay. This great huge thing whacking at my cheek. As I was saying, and it's not so different from one incarnation to the next, is it? You just see someone and then there's just something so familiar about them. You have to wait just a minute. Sometimes you have to wait a week or a year and then you realize, oh, this is someone I know. This is someone who has a meaningful relationship to me. Even though sometimes with the mind you couldn't reason that out at all. It has to be, it's the soul's power of knowing that this is a relationship that transcends this moment-to-moment reality. Now that, let me just find where I was going. Oh, I was talking about when I met Swami. I gave the manuscript before it was published. Our friend, Mr. Kartikeyan, who's a well-known man in India who was visiting at our house at the time, and I gave him the manuscript to read because he was a bit, he didn't at that time know Swami and Ananda that well, so he was kind of like my canary in the cage to see whether he would relate to the book. Well, he came downstairs after reading just the beginning and he said, that was quite unreasonable of you, wasn't it, to just make that decision so quickly? He said, and then he kept sort of arguing with me, like it would make people think that I wasn't reliable. I said, well, sir, what I see is that the rest of my life proves that it was a reliable decision. But, you know, just looking at it reasonable, he was partly playing the devil's advocate with me, just teasing me a little bit. But nonetheless, of course, it does seem unreasonable. If you're just thinking from the mind, for Peter to turn to Christ, who was just this ragamuffin who was being scorned by everyone and eventually was executed, you know, just executed like a common criminal. Try to think about that. Just think about the person that you're following that you think is the Son of God being executed like a common criminal, and the whole power structure and the police and the government are all just taking him away and then putting him somewhere and shooting him. You know, reason, it's really hard to hold on to that because such a force. And what happened is many of the disciples ran away. Only a few were able to hold on to their inner knowing sufficiently. But you see, that's what the whole spiritual path is. There really can't be any spiritual path that is just based on the mind. Because if it's just on the mind, it simply isn't strong enough. Because, for among other things, the mind itself dies. Master said something so interesting about death itself. He said the tremendous importance, if possible, of being able to retain some consciousness as the body passes away. The practice of meditation is the practice of being consciously aware without the use of the senses or the mind, to transcend those rather limited realities and get into the presence of your connectedness to the soul. Of the soul's power of knowing its eternal existence in God. Master said if an individual believes that consciousness comes only from the brain, when that person is on his or her deathbed and the brain begins to die, Master put it in this charming way, he feels obligated to go unconscious. because he can't imagine how he could be conscious except through the senses. I just love that. He feels obligated. It's like he has to be consistent with the beliefs he's held this whole time. And even if there is like a glimmer of light or an angel trying to tell him, you don't have to go into the sort of gray regions of lack of awareness. He said, but most people, just believing that this is all there is, just fade away and that's where they go. And he said, and then they kind of have a semi-dreamless sleep in the astral world. And they don't really become conscious again until they have senses and a brain to be conscious with, which is mean until they're in a baby's body again. Others who are aware of the fact, who have lived in the soul's power of knowing, when the body begins to fade, there can be anxiety, there can be some uncertainty. After all, if you've lived in one place for a really long time and you're not really quite sure and you don't remember anymore exactly how you used to function, there's this anxiety a little bit where you can't breathe and you're just concerned, what's going to happen to me now? But then that light begins to come and all of a sudden, intuition, the soul's power of knowing comes back in full force, undiminished anymore with this heavy veil of flesh. It's not that by any means that we become God-realized or shed our self-definitions altogether, but nonetheless we can retain that consciousness and go to a higher astral world and define our future lives on a more refined level. Of course, that's where all of us are living, because here we are. We were able to see it. We were able to see even the concept of Christ incarnate, Christ in consciousness, Christ within us. That's what we're living with now. We had, last night, we did our children's play. I was referring to it earlier, which we do every year on some great spiritual figure. And this year, the story was the life of the Buddha. It's an extraordinary production. Many of you witnessed one or more of the performances. If you missed it, I must tell you, you must come next year to the play that we do. These are really extraordinary shows. Just inherently, they're extraordinary. And to be done by children makes them even more so. But of course, they are done by children. And so certain parts of it are a little bit truncated. And you can't have small children go on and on explaining every single nuance of the philosophy. Plus, the philosophy of Buddhism, of Buddha, has been a little bit corrupted in the same way that that Catholicism has been and Hinduism has been, Krishna's teachings have been. Followers of Krishna don't often understand what it was that he really taught. And when a master incarnates, he tends to come as a corrective energy, that there's something that's a little off in society, so he comes with a new message, a new expression of a timeless truth that put things in balance. Master came to correct several very wrong impressions that have been remnants of Jesus' teachings. When Jesus came, he taught first that God is a father, not a harsh judge. And secondly, he taught kindness and love toward one another, because that picture of God as a harsh judge had caused people to imitate in their own lives that same kind of harshness. And so Jesus came and said, God is our Father, and our Father loves us, and he will take care of us. And as God loves us, we must love one another. That was his great message, to love one another. Now, of course, the way that has gotten distorted is that Christianity is enormously based nowadays on loving one another and serving and helping the poor and the downtrodden, which, of course, there's nothing wrong with that, except what Jesus was trying to tell us is to love God in one another. Because loving God, loving the infinite spirit, love thy neighbor as thyself, the actual truer way to say that is love thy neighbor because he is thyself. And what is the self but the infinite within you? And that's what we say in the Festival of Light every week. Jesus came to the great master Babaji and he says, my followers have lost touch. The candle still burns on the lower altar of good works, but the noble taper of inner communion burns low and is ill attended. There's no longer this understanding that we have to look within and change our consciousness to be as Peter was able to be, in the power of the soul's knowing, in relationship not only to ourselves but to the masters. So Master himself was sent by Babaji with this message, and this message is inner communion. And the other reality that Master came to correct is moving a step closer to the inner warmth of the Spirit. Jesus could only go from the judge to the Father, but Master has been able to go from the Father to the Mother. Because as we have this tape of Master's voice saying, the Mother is much closer than the Father. Because if we want to bring this power of Spirit out of all external concern into our own inner reality and through the practice of Kriya Yoga, raise that Kundalini energy to the spiritual eye and merge into that infinite Spirit, what we're experiencing is the love and the bliss that is not this external reality, but our own nature. When Buddha came at a time when everybody was only thinking about all the external forms of God and was completely dependent on God to do this and God to do that. And you see hints of it, and for those of you who saw the play, the gods are not that powerful. They can't really ease our suffering. They're not able to really save us. And so Buddha didn't want to talk about God. Buddha only wanted to talk about our own effort and how we have to live. But as a result, Buddhists are now virtual atheists. And in fact, a lot of Christians find it easier to be Buddhists than to be Hindus or self-realizationists as we are, because the question of God doesn't enter into it, and therefore it doesn't conflict. It's just a question of mindfulness and doing the right thing. But there's sort of a flaw in it, because certainly we are motivated to escape suffering, but that's not enough. What we really long for is joy. It's one thing to say that if I don't do this, I won't hurt, but that's so cowardly. That's so unattractive. Oh, it's just like saying, follow the safe path. Don't go there, don't go there, don't go there. I mean, youth itself rebels against that energy when the parents put it on us when we were younger. We want to go out. Yes, it's reckless, but that's just what we want to do. Why would we play it safe? And sometimes in the play last night, I cringed a little bit because the teaching comes across as, you'll suffer if you do that, you'll suffer if you do that, you'll suffer if you do that, and who cares? I will face the great life. There was even one unfortunate line, the more you love, the more you suffer. Oops, you know? And so then we have this little boy playing the king, and he's very resistant to Buddhist teaching, and then you have his daughter, and so his wife says, if something happened to your daughter, wouldn't you suffer? And the king says, I think I'll go see the Buddha. There was a little bit of a quick transition in there. But what he was trying to say was the whole sermon I'm trying to give. If you live on the waves of the sea, when those waves crash, your heart will break. But we have to understand that the real power that Buddha also was offering to his disciples, even though the Buddhists now just talk about suffering, 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 the real thing that he was saying is, break the veil of suffering, because on the other side of it is not nothing, but is everything your heart is longing for. I was listening to a group of people, just total strangers in a restaurant, just sort of talking to each other, and there was so much affirmation of having a good time. The word hearty kept coming to me. They were being so hearty with one another, you know, just trying to stir up a little bit of energy. That's why people drink, and that's why people take drugs, because it gives them the illusion that something is happening. A teenage friend asked one of his mentors, an older mentor, you know, how can I tell if I'm drinking too much? How can I tell if I'm taking drugs too much? He said, when you begin to think, this would be a lot more fun if we were stoned. I thought it was a very good sort of way of putting it, meaning that pleasure is enhanced if I drug myself up, that my own consciousness can no longer suffices for me to find what I'm seeking. But people like those intoxicants because it gives them the illusion that something is happening, that they don't have to live anymore in their consciousness as it actually is. And we're always being very, very, people sometimes especially, very, very outward. And you sit in a restaurant and you watch the table next to you drink more and more wine. Maybe some of you sit at that table. I don't sit at that table. And so it confuses me. I just sort of, we're sitting there and all of a sudden they're just getting more and more hearty. And I can't figure out why they're getting so hearty. I know when people drink, you can't hear as well. So they talk louder. That's what one of my physician friends told me. But also you just see them, from my perspective, affirming more and more that they're having a really good time. laughing louder and longer at things that aren't funny, you know, and just finding enormous humor in nothing at all, just like people who go the other way with drugs. It's just all the same thing. There's nothing happening, but we're just trying to whip that wave up a little bit more. But it never works. I mean, it would be a great system if it worked. There's only one problem with it. It doesn't work. It's not a sin. It won't send you to hell. None of that. It just doesn't work. Because, as St. Augustine or St. someone put it, our hearts were made for thee alone. And we will never find our rest, Lord, until we find our rest in thee. And it's just a fact. It's a divine law. There is an inescapability about divine law. Joy is within you. And we can run and 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 run for millions of incarnations, seeking it everywhere until the soul's power of knowing penetrates. And against all reason, it went again in our little play last night, one of the Buddha himself, one of the little boys who was playing Buddha, he goes out from his father tries to protect him from this prediction that he's going to leave the world and become a monk. His father wants him to become a king, as he is. So he builds this false world of perfection around him. But the young prince wants to go out into the world, and then they clean up the whole city. But an aging man, a sick man, and a dead person cross his vision. And Buddha's so shocked, he says to his chariot driver, why is that man lying so still? And he says, Lord, he's dead. Dead? Like this? Because the Buddha has been protected from knowing this. Dead? Does this happen to everyone? Yes, everyone. You know, that's what happened. And the Buddha says, all these people all dressed up? He said, why do we clothe our garments in such beautiful things? How can people be so free when at any moment they could be felled by sickness and death? And to him it's so confusing, because if the wave is going to fall, why cling to the wave? Now, the objection that came to my mind when I heard that line was, well, why not have a good time while you can? But the problem is, it doesn't satisfy. You have a good time, you're very hearty, but then sooner or later, there's just that realization. This just isn't taking me anywhere. Our hearts are restless, Lord, and they will be restless until we find our rest in thee. This is the soul's power of knowing that, like just a constant om in the background, it just keeps resonating until finally we ourselves develop the capacity to just put aside all other restless forces trying to convince us, and we see the simple truth. Thou art the living Christ, as Peter said, and upon this rock, Christ could say, I will build the temple of divine consciousness.